from Springfield, this is State Week in Review, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
You read the audit, and it's clear that we have more work to do to get to the bottom of this. Our efforts here certainly are not duplicative of those in law enforcement.
You don't have to subpoena the records, and you don't have to FOIA the records. You make an appointment, you come in, and you take a look.
We have 20 banker's boxes of documents that neither the Democrat or Republican staff have bothered to go over and look at.
You know, politics as usual, it's a political time of year. We shut the program down, that's the bottom line. We did it 2 years ago.
The path we're on is not a good one. The idea that we can have some successful school districts while others fall behind is not what we should be doing here.
It looks like, yet again, this is an attempt to reach into the suburban pockets to solve other people's problems.
That comment from Senator Matt Murphy, a Republican from Palatine, and just before that, Senator Andy Menar, a Democrat from Macoupin County, as they're talking about an education funding proposal that has a bit of life in the state legislature. Before that, we heard some more discussions going on about the controversial Neighborhood Recovery Initiative up in Chicago. We'll be talking about that later in the show. But getting attention is a plan to change school funding that would shift a larger share of the state funding to poorer school districts. That'll be among the topics we chat about on State Week. I'm Bill Wheelhouse. Our panel includes Charlie Wheeler, Director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield, Amanda Venicky, State House Bureau Chief for WUIS and Illinois Public Radio, IPR and WUIS State House Reporter Brian Mackey, and our guest this week, Nicole Wilson, Illinois State Correspondent for 24/7 News. Nicole, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the big topic that's getting a lot of attention and a lot of discussion, as anything education funding related always does, is that Senator Andy Menar, a Democrat, a first-term Democrat who happened to serve as the chief of staff for the Senate president for a number of years prior to becoming a rookie lawmaker, is out with a school funding initiative. And Brian Mackey, we'll kind of start for the broad paintbrush with you.
Yeah, this has been out there for a while. He's been holding hearings around the state on this topic. And finally, what happened this week is the Illinois State Board of Education came out with an analysis where they were able to say how individual school districts would fare under this change. So Illinois has a very complicated funding formula currently, and schools in Illinois are really funded largely based on their property taxes. So if you're in a very wealthy area, like some of the Chicago suburbs, you have a lot of money to spend, and you can have swimming pools and driver's ed and fancy marching band instruments and things like that. And if you're in some downstate rural districts or some of the really poor areas in the Chicago suburbs or even the Chicago schools themselves, you have a lot less money to spend. And, you know, you end up cutting arts programs and you have science textbooks that are 10, 15 years old. So what this would do is attempt to change the way state funding for education is distributed by basing it more on how much poverty is in individual school districts.
And when that report came out, of course, it showed while there was a general trend that downstate schools would get more, that wasn't always the case. And nor was it the case that all suburban schools would lose money under the plan. But it did show that changing how you throw that pot of money around could impact schools in different ways. Are you seeing support from lawmakers now that they've had this feel that not all schools in their legislative districts will necessarily fare well?
I mean, I think it's kind of a geographic issue, as a lot of things are in Illinois, right? If you're in an area that's going to be a winner, well, it sounds pretty good. And if you're in an area that's going to be a loser, it probably doesn't sound so good to you. And we heard Matt Murphy right there at the top of the show saying you're reaching into suburban pockets to solve other people's problems. Of course, he's speaking for a very particular kind of suburb. Palatine is not Robbins or, you know, some of the other really impoverished suburbs where they could use some more state funding for schools.
Well, and Bill, as you indicated in that report, it wasn't separated out just by school district. It was literally separated out by legislative district. So you can see pretty quickly where legislators are going to lean on this. The argument that you get from senators like Menar is that it shouldn't matter, that right now how the funding formula is set up in Illinois is simply not fair, that it shouldn't be just where a student lives. It shouldn't be dependent on a zip code, how the quality of their education. And he was buttressed in that. And a lot of people were surprised that this report showed that Chicago public schools and how they would fare. And you have legislators from even that area going, it would get rid of the Chicago Block Grant. He did also, I should add, kind of recraft and retool the legislation, made some tweaks to try and make it a bit more appealing.
I think that the bottom line difficulty is for many, many years, Illinois has relied much more heavily than any other state in the union on local property taxes. Local property taxes statewide pay about 60% of the cost of education. The state's contribution is about 30%. The rest comes from the federal government. National averages are closer to 45 state, 45 local, 10% national government. And so as a result, your zip code really does make a big difference. If you live in a community that has wealthy property values, or that has a big shopping center, or that has a nuclear power plant or a major manufacturing facility, you have a property tax base that allows you to raise lots of money with a pretty low tax rate and provide a really high class education for your kids. On the other hand, if you live in a rural district where there's no major manufacturing, it's mostly farmland, which gets a tax break on property taxes, you're struggling to have sufficient resources even to pay for the basic programs. Now, since the early 70s, the state has attempted to remedy this by allocating a large chunk of state aid based on factors like local property value, the number of low-risk or at-risk, low-income kids in the district. But there's also a number of grants that are given for things like special education, school transportation, bilingual education that don't take into account the wealth of a district. What Menar's plan is trying to do is to take all of these separate programs and put them into a singular formula where individual students would be weighted depending on what their needs are. So an at-risk student would count proportionally more than a not at-risk student, or a student who was learning English would count a tad bit more than a native English speaker. And crunching all this stuff together, by Menar's estimate, something like 90%+ of state aid would go based on these factors, the so-called poverty type factors, and the remainder, mostly for early childhood and certain types of special education, would be given out the way it is today. And as a result, you have winners and losers. In the Chicago area, there are 65 school districts, most of them in the south suburbs, that would be winners. There's more than 200 that would be losers. Downstate, according to the State Board of Education, you would have 410 winners, 165 losers. And so it is very much, to support what Murphy is saying, it is taking money, state money, away from wealthy suburban districts to give it to basically poor downstate districts.
And I think part of the argument with that is, schools that can sustain themselves should sustain themselves because they're getting more money in as it relates to those property taxes, whereas those in, the more rural districts or the poorer districts cannot sustain themselves. And so they can't buy books and they can't get the fancy swimming pools, as Brian referred to earlier. And I think, that's part of the argument. So, when you're taking your hand and putting it into the suburban pockets and giving that money to poorer districts, some are arguing, well, you shouldn't have a problem with that because these schools will be okay. They won't miss that state money. Whereas people in other districts really do need it.
And that's something that's so counterintuitive about the way property taxes work, is that if you live in a poorer area, the property tax rate has to be higher. So, yeah, people who live in Winnetka and places like that, yeah, they have a huge dollar amount bill. But as a share of what their property is actually worth, a lot of times they pay less. And this is, you know, this education funding overhaul has been kind of a distant target for people for so many years, decades. I mean, there was the citizen, was it Committee versus Edgar, Citizens versus Edgar? Charlie, you can correct me on that. Mm-hmm. Now, there have been lawsuits about this. There was another lawsuit just a couple of years ago trying to attack this property-based funding system. And this is, I mean, there's always excitement every few years when another proposal like this comes around. And, you know, so far, none of them have been successful.
Well, and this is, of course, an election year. So that's why it's widely seen that this doesn't have a chance of getting through the General Assembly. I do think that, Bill, when you had mentioned Senator Andy Menar and that he happened to be the chief of staff, it's more than just that. You wouldn't normally have a freshman legislator getting this deep into an issue or really even getting that far with it had he, I'm guessing, not had that history with Senate President Cullerton, who's given Menar both this reign and also the weight of possibility, at least in that chamber, of going forward. When asked about it, Speaker Mike Madigan has said, what are you talking about, basically? Nonetheless, the issue of property taxes all plays very much into what Governor Pat Quinn has made a plank of his budget plan. He says, yeah, I want to extend the income tax hike of 2011 that was supposed to be temporary because we need it. But wait a second, I'm also going to give property tax relief. And he says, if his plan doesn't go forward, that will lead to even higher property taxes wherever you live, whatever the state of your school district, because it's going to mean cuts to schools from the state level that will have to be made up locally.
And follow up on a comment Brian made, Charlie. We also had a constitutional amendment question back in the 90s asking if the state should pay the preponderant share. And while it received a majority of votes, it did not get the requisite kind of supermajority required on a constitutional amendment. And that would have forced the state to fund schools more at the time.
Well, I'm not sure. It certainly would have encouraged the state. The difficulty is the Constitution.
Don't know whether it would have enforced them. Yeah,
because the Constitution as is says that the state has the primary responsibility. And there was a case in the early 70s where the court in essence said this is wishful thinking. It's a hortatory statement. This is a goal, but it's not enforceable. And the attempt, as you said, in the 90s, in 1990, was to change the wording to say preponderant and to require, to try and put more teeth into it, in essence. But there's still the problem. I'm not sure that you can force, that the Supreme Court can force the General Assembly to allocate additional funds. I think you have a question of the separation of powers there. I'm not a lawyer, obviously, but I would think that would be difficult. And the one lawsuit that is still pending is based on violations of the Civil Rights Act that Brian alluded to. It was brought, I believe, by the Chicago Urban League, and it's still pending in the Cook County Circuit Courts. And the argument there is that because, by and large, particularly in the suburban area, the school districts that are really poor tend to have an overwhelming percentage of minority students, and therefore this is discriminatory the way the state allocates its dollars. And as a matter of fact, in the suburban area, again referring to the analysis by the State Board of Education, in the South Cook County area, there are 66 school districts. 35 of them would actually come out ahead. 31 wouldn't. And some of these districts have the highest property tax rates for education of anywhere in the state, probably three times anyway what we pay here in Springfield. And Brian, you're familiar with that area. That's your old stomping grounds, right?
Indeed it is. And my mother was a school superintendent in that area. So, I mean, there is a lot of need in the south suburbs. It's not, you know, people talk about the suburbs as being kind of a wealthy area of the state, a very Republican area, but there are certainly parts of the south suburbs that are much needier.
Well, anywhere, and that's what makes it difficult. I mean, you look at the capital city, so Springfield Public Schools would benefit under this new formula, but some of the quote-unquote suburbs of Springfield, Chatham and Rockford, would lose.
Rochester would be the...
I'm sorry. Yeah. Thank you. Yes, Rochester, not Rockford.
And you, but cities like Springfield and Decatur, to name two downstate cities, do have a high poverty rate as there has been an exodus to the nearby communities for some of those schools. As you alluded to earlier, Amanda, and anybody else at the State House, feel free to chime in. You thought it might come up for a vote in the Senate, might get its day in the sun in the Senate. It probably won't be heard in the House this spring. So do you foresee a vote in the Senate, or do you see them holding with it right now and just saying it's still an issue we're studying and continuing this march forward and keeping educators possibly excited about a potential for change in the school funding mechanisms?
I wouldn't be surprised either way, in a sense. I think that you've seen, for example, with the non-attempt to take a vote in the Senate for a graduated income tax, it was seen as, why vote for that in the Senate if it doesn't have a chance of passing the House and getting people on the record with something that is controversial? And whereas Senator Menard had a very close race first time around, he's not in that situation now, so he doesn't necessarily need that bump. It is clearly something that he and others care about. It could well be something that, who knows, maybe the Senate throws it out as a distraction of sorts as they're attempting to get the larger budget issues at hand resolved. That said, it goes back to, as I indicated, in terms of the progressive income tax and no vote there. It would also make sense for the Senate to wait and hold off if it doesn't have any chance of going forward in the other chamber.
And I would just say, compared to the House, though, the Senate is more willing to take a flyer on kind of fantasy, you know, and when I say fantasy, I just mean like what people view as the ideal. You know, they have voted for very unpopular things in the past because they think it's the right thing to do, even, you know, kind of, and then the House ends up being Lucy pulling the football away from Charlie, and the Senate is there making this kick, and they have these votes on record, but then the House never follows
through.
Right,
I mean, the Senate has this supermajority, and they have very few contested races, whereas in the House, yes, Democrats have a supermajority, but it's a lot more tenuous and a lot more races in play with Republicans. And I think a lot of that, looking to the Republican race and wondering what's going to come of it. So not willing to take risks over there.
And I think you were referring to football being taken away from Charlie.
Charlie Brown.
This is State Week in Review. Just ahead, we'll discuss the latest on that neighborhood recovery initiative and how it keeps maintaining itself in the news of the state capitol.
Support for State Week in Review comes from the Illinois State Bar Association, providing professional services to Illinois lawyers and education and services to the public. Information at IllinoisLawyerFinder.com.
Our panel on State Week, Charlie Wheeler, Amanda Venicky, Brian Mackey, and 24/7's Nicole Wilson. I'm Bill Wheelhouse. The other issue that seems like it's been a frequent topic of discussion lately is that controversial plan that 4 years ago was given to Chicago, $50-some million dollars just prior to an election, the Neighborhood Recovery Initiative, an anti-violence program that an audit showed maybe the money wasn't managed well, maybe some of the money didn't end up in the correct hands. This week, on the heels of already that authorities are looking on it at least from two fronts, the Legislative Audit Commission and a Republican co-chair of that, Senator Jason Barrickman, decided that they needed to grant themselves subpoena power. And should we be quivering now that they have granted themselves subpoena power?
You know, I think that, and I do want to just to make one point of clarification, the money before the governor's office calls yet again, because they have really been watching every word of every story on this. The money did not technically go out until after the election, although many of the contracts were signed before the election. So parse that as you will, but we just, because I've been getting a lot of calls from the governor's office this week. But,
well, having worked in state government, I know once the contract is signed, you're obligated.
Yeah, you would think that nonsense
unless
about...
You're, yeah, unless you're Rod Blagojevich, where, you know, where you have to sign memorandums of understanding to say you'll follow through on your contracts. But yes, to your point, Bill, should the Quinn administration be worried about this subpoena power now? I wouldn't. As the Auditor General made a point we heard at the top of the show, you don't really need subpoenas to look at these documents. You can just make an appointment, as the federal prosecutors have done. You can make an appointment and come and look at the documents, as the Cook County State's attorney has done. You can make an appointment and look like many news outlets have done. This is not something where you necessarily need to be subpoenaing records. And practically, whether these subpoenas will have any effect is another big question, because you have to have Democrats willing to go along with it. The way they crafted this plan, you need at least the committee co-chair, who is one of the people who expressed skepticism about this. He's the Frank Martino we heard from at the top of the show, saying we have boxes and boxes of documents and neither of our staffs have been over to look at them yet. So he would have to sign off on it before any subpoenas were issued.
And so, not just Martino would have to sign off on this. Even once they commit, you know, create the subcommittee and determine which documents they want and who they want to testify, they still need Mike Madigan and John Cullerton's signatures on this, which we don't know, you know, where they're leaning on this. Are they going to say, hey, yeah, we want to subpoena this information? And then you have the whole thing with, because there is, you know, a federal probe, and because the state, Cook County State's Attorney, is looking into this, you know, will they be limited in what they can get so they don't hinder those investigations or anything like that? And even still, if they do get the subpoena powers and if they do get to hear from these witnesses, those witnesses can take the fifth. They don't have to say, you know, what they know or what they think, because then again, they may implicate themselves in the event of a criminal investigation. And so there's still a whole lot here that isn't really solid yet. It's just a move Republicans say they want to have in case they need their hands on that.
You know what it accomplished, though, and the only reason Quinn should be scared is because he shouldn't be quivering by any means, but it kept it in the news. We're talking about it for yet another week.
Well,
and
that's the whole,
no,
that's the whole purpose of this,
whole point.
This nonsense about the subpoena. There's absolutely no need for it. The Legislative Audit Commission is not an investigative body in the sense of someone pursuing criminal acts. Their job is to look at the audits that the Auditor General does on the agencies and decide, are there any changes we need in state law or in regulations to deal with these kinds of issues? Now, there is plenty of work for them to do based on the audit that the Auditor General Bill Holland did, in terms of tightening up how contracts are awarded, requiring additional documentation on the RFPs, the request for proposals. There's a whole bunch of stuff that could be changed. Doesn't have anything to do with criminal liability, which, as I say, is outside that commission's authority. So I see it as just another. I think the things I've suggested in terms of changing the process are valuable and worthwhile and should be looked at. But this idea of subpoenaing people, we're going to get to the bottom of this, I think that's just partisan nonsense.
I guess so. What they're really trying to subpoena, perhaps, here are press releases when they can say that they've subpoenaed somebody. However, it should be noted, and only one person voted against it, though. It's a bipartisan panel, and it did have pretty much the support of the committee.
And the person who voted against it was the Democratic co-chair, who would have to sign off on the subpoenas, Frank Martino.
And I think that people who were on this commission thought it was kind of watered down. You know, it's not. I don't think they're really that worried about it, because you do have those checks we discussed. And I should say there is some question. I think Republicans would contend that the Speaker and Senate President don't have to sign off on it, but the Democrats do, and they have the majority, and they tend to get to have their way with these things. But I think Charlie's right. This is mainly about getting more publicity out of this, keeping it in the headlines. And in that regard, the Republicans had a pretty big success this week.
We'll move now to notes from the field. And Brian Mackey, we'll start with you.
Yeah, I want to mention State Representative Mike Bost from Murfreesboro. He is running for Congress against sitting Congressman Bill Enyart. Bost is a Republican. Enyart is a Democrat. And he moved his very last bill, he says, as a member of the Illinois House of Representatives. Mike Bost this week has not just this week, but he has been a longtime person who is very showy on the House floor. There was kind of a big blow up he had a year or two ago where he threw some papers up in the air and it made BuzzFeed and all these national websites. So I just thought it was a good time to revisit one of my favorite moments from Mike Bost on the floor of the House. He was very frustrated that some Republican bills were being bottled up, and so he invoked the Old Testament.
I feel like somebody trying to be released from Egypt. Let my people go!
And so I thought at the time that it would be a fun exercise to say, who wore it better, Mike Bost or Charlton Heston?
I feel like somebody trying to be released from Egypt. Let my people go!
Thus saith the Lord God of Israel. Let my people go.
So we report, you decide, Mike Bost or Moses.
And are we implying that the legislature is as lost as those with Moses?
I report, you decide.
Charlie Wheeler.
Well, the Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability came out with a report that suggested the state is going to take in a lot more money this year than was originally estimated at the time the budget was put together. In fact, something in excess of $1 billion. And rather than spend the money on new programs or anything else, a group of Republicans has suggested, I think quite wisely, that the money be used to pay the back pay due Ask Me employees after a court decision of a couple years ago to the neighborhood of, I think, something like $111 million, and use the rest of that money to pay off the bills, which the comptroller has, which are somewhere in the neighborhood of $4 or $5 billion. So I think that is what we ought to do with that kind of windfall.
Nicole Wilson.
Medicaid is still, you know, a hot topic here in Springfield, and, you know, Republicans are saying, hey, you know, Governor Quinn is trying to unravel reforms that we've already made, and, you know, they're saying we don't want any benefit increases or any more, you know, program expansions until we can actually meet that 50% target of getting half of those Medicaid recipients into managed care. And they say we have about 18% right now and until the end of the year to reach that goal. And so they're saying, hey, we need to pull in the reins on Medicaid expansion right now.
And Amanda Vinicky.
You had both gubernatorial candidates yet again speaking at the same time to a group of business leaders, Illinois retailers and manufacturers, and it was most definitely, I would say, powers of observation, a more receptive audience to Bruce Rauner. It was interesting to watch a couple of business owners get up and speak to the crowd talking about their frustrations with Illinois' high taxes and bureaucracy and what have you, and then lo and behold, Governor Pat Quinn takes the stage right after we're talking about his budget plan. The governor, however, calling out Bruce Rauner for yet again saying that he will unveil a comprehensive financial plan for Illinois soon, but refusing to say when that is. Mum's the word, mm-hmm. is what Quinn says about Rauner's plan. If we have time, I will add that Rauner's facing some more legal troubles of his own regarding his former investment company and a federal bankruptcy judge in Florida letting continue a case that involves GTCR, and so that will linger for him throughout the election.
And that's our time for this edition of State Week. I want to thank Nicole Wilson of 24/7 News for joining us today. You can get a podcast of this show by going to WUIS.org, or if using a desktop or laptop, find it on iTunes by searching State Week in Review. Production assistance for our program today provided by Senta Sieber. I'm Bill Wheelhouse.
You've been listening to State Week in Review, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week in Review is produced in the state capitol by public radio station WUIS. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.